Welcome to episode 157 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts Andrew, David, and Jen. This week we read Berserk by Kentaro Miura. And now, the cast begins.
I'm looking at the cover for volume 2 of Arrow, and it's like the boobs are so big it's making me feel sick. Because it's just not natural. It's not natural, and it's so unnatural that it's making me feel ill. Like when you're watching a porno and then something just way too weird happens and you get that oh god, turn it off now feeling.
Yeah.
I'm looking at these covers and I'm getting that sensation. And I think that's the opposite of what they want.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, there's some people who like that kind of thing.
I don't know. It's been 2003 and onward. Still has not ended.
Wow.
I've been running for 10 years.
Every time we go into the comic book store, at Legends, Grant is always like, "Ooh, you guys should read Tarot. It looks so classy."
Well, now we're going to.
Yep. I don't think he really meant it for that one.
I think I put Tarot on there.
Okay.
Because I remember reading, what's his name? Chris Sims from Comics Alliance. He would post Tarot stuff every once in a while. But how it was the best terrible comic you could pick up.
I remember that. I used to read those articles.
Yeah.
He's pretty funny.
He posted that until Batman Odyssey came out. And then it was one-upped.
His rundown of Batman Odyssey is excellent, though.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
Oh, I got your text that you were watching Kenshin, and then I forgot to reply. How far did you get?
Kurogasa, the dude with the fear eyes.
Oh, cool.
I just finished that. Yeah. Just finished that.
Cool. So next up is ninjas.
Yeah, ninjas. Sick. Okay.
Sweet ninjas. Yeah.
Oh my god, my fan translation was horrible. Horrible.
Aww. Yours really? Too?
Horrible. For the first, volume, his name was Gats.
Yo, I think we read the same one. We must have read the same one. And then the last one, it's Guts. G-U-T-T-S. And I was like, that's gotta be wrong, because the first two were Gats. And then I went
to one from
Wikipedia, I'm like, oh, it is Guts.
I got it from Mango. From the first Mango one.
Yeah. Mm. That's the only problem with Mango is that, there's 7 or 8 different databases and, 4 or 5 different fan translations. It's like, fuck, I don't know which one to pick.
Did yours have color pages?
No.
Oh, so I got
one
from...
The cover of number one is in color. That's it.
Okay. The one I got was listed as most beautiful scans or something. So it has... the beginning of each chapter in color.
Huh.
I don't know. It must have been released like that in some special edition. So it's like you open it and the first thing you get is full color, beautifully drawn sex scene with that demon. And it's okay.
We have to go down, no doubt.
Save it for next week, David. We can't get pervy till next arc.
Oh, man.
It's going to
be fun.
Oh, yes, it will be. Well, you guys ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody. Welcome to another gutsy episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey.
David.
Hey.
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 And this week we read Berserk Volume 1 by Kentaro Miura. How bad did I fuck it up?
Miura.
Did I get Kentaro right?
Yeah, that was good.
Okay. So this collects just 3 stories. The Black Swordsman, The Brand, and The Guardians of Desire. So this was really fucking violent. Even for a manga, this was really violent.
Well, I think more than just violent, it's pretty graphic. So I sat down to read this while I was at lunch at a restaurant. And I opened the first page and I was like, I should probably not read this in this restaurant where everyone can see what I'm looking at. Because here's
sex with a demon.
Swordsman having sex with a demon.
It's classy.
Yep.
And it doesn't like even, I think the reason it comes off as so graphic is because the other manga that I've read, right? Like when Kenshin would do the killing blow, right? It goes into silhouettes. And then there's, like, an empty frame. And then there's a frame with, like, splatter or, like, thud noises, right? And you don't actually see the blade going through the dude. But in this one, they have no problem showing you the blade going through the dude. They have no problem showing you Guts being balls deep in this demon. Like, that's right there, top of the page. See everything. Like, this, I think what makes this set apart and why it feels extra violent, at least extra gorier, like you said, David, graphic, because it's like it doesn't shy away from showing you anything the way I think other manga does.
Yeah.
So is that a good thing?
I don't know. I think it walks the line between, like, well, I think it's right at the edge before it tips into gratuitous. I don't know. I think really it depends on who's reading it. I mean, like I said, I didn't want people to have to look at that while I was reading it in the restaurant, but I didn't really have any problems reading it myself. Like, I was able to get through it and not get sick to my stomach or anything like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of other things we've read that have been way too much for me. Like, Super God? Was just,
oh, yeah.
There were scenes in that that were Jesus. Like, no. And then, I don't know, like, I've been reading Attack on Titan recently, and that's really, really violent, and that bothers me sometimes. But here, I kind of looked at it, and my response wasn't disgust so much as, like, damn, that's harsh.
So, yeah.
I find it strange, because it's very gratuitous, yet I didn't find it bad.
I think that part of the reason why maybe this is more palatable to people is that it's almost into the realm of hyperbole. It's just like so insane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, my wife, for example, sometimes has trouble with things that are really graphic. Like, she stopped watching Battlestar Galactica when we got to, I don't remember where it was in the show, but it's the part where they capture a six and she's like basically raped in the prison cell.
Oh, the one on Pegasus?
Yeah, the one on Pegasus. And so she couldn't watch a show after that anymore. But she can watched Attack on Titan with no problems.
And she's read all of Walking Dead too, right?
Not the most recent stuff, but she read the first 11 volumes of the first 11 trades.
It's quite a lot of zombies.
And so she, you know, she was okay with that. So, you know, it's really, like I said, from person to person, but with Berserk specifically, I think it's just totally, it's insane. So it's like, okay, this, I guess, is okay because this is so crazy that it probably couldn't happen.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you're definitely right. Like, when he uses his giant sword to cut the horse and the rider in half. And I think it was the first or the second one. Well, like, somebody's charging at him, and he just fucking swings his sword and cuts the horse in half. Or cuts the horse's head off, and then on the way cuts the dude riding it in half. Like, I laughed at that. I was like, that's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, and even the people that watch him do it are like, how is that guy even swinging that sword? Or there's a part in the first one, too, where the demon, the cobra demon, like, rides into battle.
Mm-hmm.
And he has half of a corpse on the top of his axe. And he's drinking the blood that's dripping down from it. It's like, okay, why is Serpentor's eating this child?
I'm glad we thought of the same person.
And there's like every other page is a dude with a crossbow bolt in his face, and And plus, I think part of it is what's great. What helps it is that there's a opposite perspective too. Like Puck, the elf, is constantly giving us the perspective of, oh my God, what is wrong with this guy? He's completely insane.
Yeah.
This is way too violent. And so maybe that there's a balance a little bit.
Puck is definitely the balance. Puck is great in this at doing that. Going like, what the fuck? What the hell, dude? Did you really just... Holy shit. I think that really is Puck's role in this, is being the audience's reaction and then showing Guts just not giving a fuck about the audience's reaction. It's kind of a nice way to interact with your reader.
Yeah, I mean, and I think at some point, too, doesn't Puck, like, look at it and say, oh my God, this is Guts' life? I think it's in the woods after he saw the priest and his granddaughter get killed.
Yeah,
by
and then
skeletons.
Yeah, it's the page where there's just like the battle of chopped up skeletons is just everywhere, and Guts is walking off, and Puck looks around at all of the skeletons and just says, "Holy shit, this is his life. It's just nothing but death and loneliness."
That's
and every,
so
and
dark.
Everyone around him who tries to help him just dies.
Yeah. And I mean, it's actually really sad if you think about it, which maybe makes the violence not so bad, because this is, like, just the world he lives in. It, I think part of it, like, David, earlier you mentioned that scene in Battlestar Galactica. I know, like, nobody wants to watch that, and I think a lot of people I know looked at it and said, why did they put that in the show? But I don't think there were any scenes in this comic where I was like, why is this in here? This is so unnecessary. Because it felt like everyday occurrence for Guts. It didn't feel like it was completely batshit crazy, but at the same time, it didn't feel like they were just doing it for show. It felt like it was to show us something specific, which is that Guts has to deal with this all the time.
Yeah, and I think that's also what really helps balance out the graphic nature of the comic, because if you see him doing all these crazy fucking things, it becomes less ridiculous when you realize, well, he's surrounded by 20 dudes. He needs a giant ridiculous sword. He needs to hack them in half right at the go from it. Like, it makes it less reproachable because he's doing it out of defense, and he's doing it because he has to go kill these monsters. Because he's branded, he has to go kill them. At least that's what I'm gathering.
Yeah.
And if he kills them all, my guess is that once he kills them all, the brand will fade and it'll go away, or I don't know. Or I don't know what the deal is, but the brand has something to do with him going around and killing these monsters.
Wait, so how much did you read, Andy, of Guardians of Desire? Did you read all six parts?
Oh, it's the whole six-part thing?
I don't know. I read all six parts of Guardians of Desire.
Oh, I thought it was just like the third volume or the third issue.
Well, yeah. So there's like at least what I read. There were six parts to Guardians of Desire. It was really. I was like, oh my God, this is really long. But it explains where he got the brand and what the brand means.
So, just for reader clarification, Volume 1 has three stories, and then the third one is Guardians of Desire, but it's only the first chapter of it, and that's the one that ends where he gets, like, the Mr. Potato Head demon.
Yes.
Oh, okay,
that's,
so yeah,
I
kept reading past that.
Okay.
So,
because I didn't know, I wasn't sure if I should stop or keep going, so I kept going.
I didn't read past it, but if you want to explain how he gets the brand, I'm really interested in finding out.
Yeah, spoiler me up.
So the brand, if there's a person who is branded,
okay,
that means they were sacrificed to the demons.
Okay.
So people who are branded were sacrificed at some point. And you actually meet the person in the last part of Guardians of Desire. You meet the person who sacrificed him. And the people who people who are doing the sacrificing, who are making the sacrifice, gain the power of demonic powers. And so the reason why his brand bleeds is because the brand prevents him from getting, it's supposed to prevent him from getting close to demons. So when he gets close to a demon, it hurts or bleeds. And the more powerful the demon, the more painful the brand is.
Okay. So, but he actually...
So the whole time he's fighting, he's just kind of fighting through it?
Yes. And so he gets, when we, and the end of the last Guardians of Desire, where we see the, where he comes face to face with the demon, with the person who sacrificed him, this guy's like a super powerful demon, and Guts like can't get within like 6 or 7 feet of him, and his brand is like gushing blood.
What a fucking badass.
And so you get like a quick flashback at the end of, or at the beginning of Guardians of Desire part six, mm-hmm. where you see Guts and this guy Griffin or Griffith together, like before Guts was sacrificed and before Griffith became a demon.
Okay.
Yeah. And it reveals what the Mr. Potato Head thing is too.
Okay.
Well, because did you get to the part where they talk about it being a key?
No.
Okay, so yeah. It turns out it's a key that opens the dimensional, opens it to the demon's dimension.
Oh. And,
yeah.
I am going to go read the rest of that after we finish podcasting, because that sounds really cool.
It was very cool. Like, I really enjoyed it. Like, the whole Garden to Desire story is pretty long. But the way it ends is pretty satisfying.
It's probably a fast read, though. All of these were a really quick read.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it was a very quick read.
Because there's so many like pages of just action and no text.
Yeah, and even the text there isn't a ton.
Yeah, Guts is not a man of many words.
Yeah, I think Puck talks a lot more than he does.
Yeah, and even then, Puck is mostly just expressions.
Yeah, and he even tells Puck that he or she talks way too much. I don't know if Puck is a boy or a girl.
I think Puck's androgynous.
Yeah,
it
I mean,
it's to be.
I don't think it. I don't think it matters really.
No, it doesn't matter. But
I think in my head I assign Puck a male gender because of the character from Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, I assigned it male. I don't know. I don't know, no boobs, and it's comics. Like, in my head, if I'm reading a comic or a manga, and it's a female character, and it's not like a C or D cup, it must be a dude. it's just my apparently incredibly sexist prejudice coming out, apparently. Because it's terrible. There's nothing wrong. No, I'm not even going to go there. That's just me being terrible and sexist. But I don't think it, like, for Puck, it doesn't matter what gender it is. And I think it's not even supposed to have a gender because it's from the Fae, you know, it's from the green world, kind of, that kind of thing. Which I think, you know, when I was reading it, it kind of bothered me a little bit because the whole thing of being from the Fae, and especially of a fairy like this, and then naming it Puck is all very, very Renaissance. But then the setting for this comic is very, very medieval. And so I was like, Definitely. Those two don't mix. And it kind of bugged me, but then I was like, who the fuck cares? This was written in Japan. It's the other side of the fucking world. Like, yeah, shit doesn't have to be exact. Who cares?
Kentaro probably read Midsummer Night's Dream, or at least was inspired by that. At least for the name Puck. But like you said, it doesn't really matter, right?
No, and I mean, you can mix shit up all you want, too, because I was like, in my head, I was kind of comparing this with Conan the Barbarian, too, a little bit, because the same kind of hack-and-slashy kind of action barbarian kind of thing, but, like, Conan doesn't have, like, any kind of continuity for Bronze Age versus Steel versus Iron versus... Like, he'll go from air to air, and technology changes wildly. This is way more consistent than that.
This is totally, like, reminded me of Robert E. Howard. Not just Conan, but also, have you guys read Solomon Kane? Or heard of Solomon Kane?
Heard of.
He's another Robert E. Howard character who is he's basically the Puritan version of Guts. He walks around and fights demons, but he's a Puritan. He wears, like, a pilgrim hat.
Oh, my God.
Oh, right. He's a complete badass, just like Guts, and he kills demons. Because if he was in his previous life, he was so evil that if he ever does another evil act, he like immediately goes to hell. So now he only fights demons.
I love the idea that he can know the balance.
Well, I think he like made some kind of deal with an angel or something.
Okay.
But he also, just like Guts, he has swords and guns.
Well, to be fair, Guts doesn't have a gun. He has a repeating crossbow.
Well, he has a cannon on
it.
That's right, he has a cannon on. I forgot about the cannon. Never mind. Yes, he does. what a fucking crazy asshole.
But yeah, if you like Guts, or if you like Berserk, and you like Robert E. Howard stuff, read Solomon Kane.
Okay, I might have to add that.
I'm down with that.
It's pretty funny.
So what do we think of Guts as a character? Like, is he even interesting? Is he anything more than just, like, a template?
Well, I found him interesting because, I mean, it took me reading, like, 8 volumes of this, or 8 chapters, to get any kind of real information about him. There's enough, like, mystery surrounding him that it makes him interesting. It's like Wolverine, you know? Like, it's not the case anymore with Wolverine because, like, they gave him an origin story and stuff. Yeah,
filled in so much background.
Yeah. I mean, Wolverine's still interesting, but I think that one of the things that made him such an awesome character back in, like, the early 90s is you didn't know where he came from.
Yeah, and I think in the comics they've even said because of his healing factor, he could be 50 years old or 500. Who the fuck knows?
Yeah. And so I think Guts is a similar character to Wolverine, at least the old version of Wolverine, like Chris Claremont, Jim Lee era, where he is a complete badass, he's morally ambiguous, and you don't know where he came from, what his purpose is. And I think that makes an interesting anti-hero, or at least protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So to me, he's an interesting character. Is he a little bit one-dimensional, at least in the stuff we read? Yeah, I think so.
And I mean, especially in the first 3, like you said, you got a lot more sense of him through having read more. In the first 3, I think we only really get a couple scenes where we get any bit of personality out of him. And I think Jen, you put the thing in the note about him almost bordering on a trope.
He is, like, he's not a trope, but all the things that make him up, like, would make a trope. Like, he has a giant sword, a crossbow hand, spiky hair, and a missing eye. And, like, if you took all of those and put them together without any craft to it, you're going to end up with, like, a walking, you know, badass guy archetype.
Yeah.
Yeah, but certainly. I agree that it could definitely go, it could go that direction if somebody made a character like this.
I mean, three of those 4 elements are also present in Zorro after the time skip. Missing eye, spiky hair, and crazy swords. Zorro from One Piece, not Zorro.
There's a very Zorro. There's a very Zorro moment at the end of Guardians of Desire.
So I think, but that does also make him feel template-y, right?
Yeah.
It's because if you look at a guy on a page and he looks like he fits a trope to a T, it's gonna take character and story to set him apart, to make him a character that can carry a story, because otherwise, you know, what's setting won't do it, and the plot itself won't do it. Like, eventually, you're going to have to get the guy to be interesting, and not just the things that he's doing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I mean, there are times when there are stories out there where there's, like, generic badass character in this awesomely crafted world, but the world can only carry so much, right? Because you can't watch the same person over and over again doing these things without any kind of growth, you know, like, I kind of get what you're, I get what you're saying.
It's like season 1 of Farscape, to bring up a terrible example. Farscape, if you watch Farscape, it's a sci-fi thing, and the world, the universe of Farscape is really, really interesting. But throughout the first season, up until, like, the last episode of season 1, the main character is just bumbling sci-fi male hero trope. Like, looks like John Crichton, looks exactly like Jack O'Neill, looks a lot like Han Solo, looks a lot like, you know, and they kind of all mesh together, except then you get the end, and then And then finally John Crichton gets a little bit of personality and fleshes himself out. But like through the whole first season, he's just like, okay, this is just a dude. And if you don't stick it through, it's real easy to quit watching that show. And so I think this kind of has that danger too, in that the world is cool. I like the idea of the demons and the medieval thing. The world building is neat, but he's kind of flat to start with. He gets there. He does get there. And I think it comes down to that scene that Jen mentioned when Puck said, so this is his life. Because Guts isn't going to be the guy who complains. He's not going to talk about his life. He's not going to ever bring up how lonely it is. He's never going to volunteer any information about himself. So you have to get his character from observation, which is also, like, Puck is super important for knowing who Guts is. And so, like, through that scene, when you see him walking away, you're able to understand why Guts is an asshole. And why he says things like, I don't give a shit about the ants who get trampled under my feet. Like, that's fucked up, bro. Like, that was a family. That was a dude and his daughter. And you just, like, called them ants. And said, they shouldn't have gotten my fuck away.
Yeah, I think, and we, and even we get in the first couple, volumes, or chapters, I guess I should say, we get little glimpses of it. Like, the first part where I really thought, okay, there's more to him than just this guy who hacks his way through armies and leaves destruction in his wake. When the priest offers him a ride in the wagon, he's like, no, I don't think I... It's okay, I don't need to ride. And he's like, really, really, get in the wagon. He's like, well, I'm just saying this for your own good.
Yeah, he does give him that warning.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes the guy up on it, and sure enough, they get attacked by skeletons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
And so I think he's protecting... He was doing... He knows the consequences of being around him, and he thought that he could try to protect these people. But then on the flip side, you know, he did end up taking the ride, and then he didn't really care when the worst happened to them. And so I think that kind of, to me, that shows the moral ambiguity there, because it's like Luke trying to, you know, find the good in Vader.
Yeah.
You know, I want to, there's goodness in this guy. Otherwise, he wouldn't be killing demons, for one thing. And he wouldn't have tried, at least made some kind of superficial attempt to protect these people.
Yeah, and Puck even mentions that. Puck says something like, if you don't care about them, why did you even warn them? Like, if you really don't care about people who are weaker than you, if you really don't, you wouldn't have hesitated to get on that thing, knowing that it was going to attract demons. You wouldn't have hesitated to take a ride and save yourself 30 steps. Fuck, why not? Right? Like, you tried to say no, and that shows that you did care at least a little bit, and that you are acting just a little bit, right?
And see, so I think that those kind of moments, at least in the first three chapters, take this flat character and make him just interesting enough to keep the reader hooked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how it worked for me.
No, same here. And honestly, I think that it's not that he only cares a little bit. Maybe I'm reading into this because I want him to be more sympathetic, but it feels like when he says he doesn't care, it's a lie. Like, there's no evidence of that, and there's nothing in the art or text to really show it. So I know it's unsubstantiated and it just might be, like, bias, but it also seems like if you're living this shitty life killing demons all the time, and then you get people killed, you start just saying that you don't care as a means to, like, protect yourself from feeling horrible about it all the time. Because, I don't know, like, the demons always say they feed off his pain and his fear and his suffering. But it can't just be because he's being hunted. Because he's a badass, you know? Like, a badass only has so much fear and suffering from demons.
Yeah.
At least that's the way I see it.
Well, especially when he's, like... We've seen him in three issues not really have much of a problem. Like, he got, quote-unquote, taken in by that demon in the beginning that he was fucking and then murdered that one. Like, okay, he got taken in on purpose. And then, like, when he got Lord Serpentis to come out to the village, right? Like, he got himself beat up and then grabbed and then brought right to the face of the guy and then blasted his face off with a cannon. It's like, okay, you meant to get the shit beat out of you so that he would get closer than he should. Like, I get the sense, okay, if you could have beat him from a distance, that would have been great, but he knew he couldn't. He knew he had to get that close, and the best way to get that close is to let him grab you and bring you close in a moment of hubris. Like, he gets fucked up, but he does it all on purpose. We don't really see him lose anything. I mean, except for, like, the friendly priest guy and his daughter. But even then, he doesn't seem to have much remorse. He seems to be able to write it off as saying, well, I told you this was going to happen, and I told you to stay inside the wagon. Why didn't you stay inside the wagon? You know? Like, he's able to write it off and uses defense mechanisms in his mind to make it not his fault.
Yeah. Oh, it's really sad if you think about it that way. Yeah. Like, as a reader, it's a little easier to think of him as a big old douchebag. But then again, I don't really like just reading people's misfortunes all the time, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think just the fact that we're kind of having this discussion about his motives shows that despite the fact that it's mostly hack and slash, he seems to be a fairly fleshed out character in that it's enough fodder for us to talk about it for however many minutes.
Yeah, and so. Well, I think it's not just his character. I think the comic has a whole tone of moral ambiguity. You know, like, the demon in the first one, right? We'll go back to Lord Serpentis. Like, what the fuck was his real name? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know.
The guy from Coca-Cola Castle. I kept saying that when I was reading it.
We'll just call him Serpentor.
Yeah, Serpentor. There we go. He was employing human beings, and those human beings were doing terrible things, thinking they were just working for a dude, right? And then as soon as they found out they were working for a monster, they all turned and ran. It's like they were perfectly happy being the bad guys until they saw somebody worse than them, and then they turned into the people fleeing. And so there's this kind of, aside from the main character, there's this kind of running thread of moral ambiguity and whether or not anybody in this is good or bad, right? Like, and the mayor in the first one, too, is a great example of this. I just remembered him. The mayor in the first raid, he's like, I'm doing this to protect the people. And he kind of was, right? Like, the whole time he was shipping off people to go get sacrificed, the town was, quote-unquote, safe. Most of the people were safe, anyway. And then as soon as they fucked up, the guy comes down and murders everyone. But if it hadn't been for that fuck-up, would that have been a bad decision? Like, yes, of course, in the general sense, it's wrong. It's wrong to go sacrifice people. But, like, needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few? I don't know.
It was women and children. And, like, yeah, everyone made it kinda clear that he was doing it so he didn't get eaten. Which I think is the moral problem here, because if he had been doing it out of, like, a genuine concern for the people and, like, having no other recourse, we could say that maybe he had a standing, but I judge him.
Yeah, and he tortured the fuck out of Guts.
Yeah.
For, like, no good reason. So, I mean, he might not be a good dude, and the women and children should tip you off right away.
Yeah.
But, like, the idea of this guy being caught in a shitty position, like, really, what the fuck is the mayor gonna do?
I respect that, but it, and actually that's a part where I kind of had a problem, because we had to take it on everyone's word that he was doing it out of selfishness,
mm-hmm.
because what does a normal person do in that situation, like, if they're not a hero?
Yeah.
Like, that's really bad.
And you never know, maybe Serpentor had a thing for women and children, and maybe he was the one asking for them.
Well, he was eating the people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe he thinks women and children taste better.
And I think, like you said, the mayor is in a really tough position, because say he refuses to comply, he's just going to get killed, and Serpentor is going to find somebody who will follow his,
yeah.
will follow him. So, I mean.
And then do we get anything similar to that in Guardians of Desire? Because the setup with the Count seems kind of like it might be something similar, where the Count is in charge and everybody else just kind of has to listen to him.
Well, yeah.
Like, a lot of the people are just kind of in fucked situations.
I don't want to spoil it for you guys any more okay. than I already have.
It just kind of feels that way from the outset.
There are. It's interesting when like everything gets revealed and goes down. Okay. There it gets interesting.
Okay. So then the other character that kind of helps highlight more ambiguity, I think, is Puck. Because like we keep bringing up, Puck is the contrast. Puck is the reader. It's us sitting from our cushy positions going, what the fuck is going on, you fucked up people? Right? And so I think this is another note you put in, Jen, about how Puck seems like way too, what was the word you put in, cutesy?
Yeah. The art style for Puck seems like something you'd find in just a much lighter anime, something like classic and kind of funny from the 90s where there's a boy and maybe a magical girl and stuff happens. Just not this.
Yeah.
You know, anything but this. And it's horrifying because Puck seems so kind and the only person who's actually kind.
Yeah.
So it's like he gets caught up in this horrible world and these horrible situations in an effort to help out someone who in the end is actually kind of mean to him. I think Guts does appreciate Puck because he does save him a couple times and, you know, he doesn't want harm to come to him, but he's also just not friendly.
I think Guts acts that way to not have to take any responsibility because he knows what the consequences that could happen if Puck hangs around.
Yeah.
But he definitely, there is some appreciation there, even though it's not clear. It's his twisted way of protecting him because he understands. So even though he'll save Puck from a bad situation, he puts up this wall and pushes Puck away in an effort to, because he understands the consequences of spending time around himself. And we see that with the priest and his daughter.
And even if Puck is able to be in a situation where he can't avoid the fight somehow, like with the priest and the daughter and the field of skeletons, right? Like, fuck, I just had a thing and it just went away. Like, even though sometimes Puck can get away, there will be a situation where Puck won't be safe. And if Guts lets Puck be a friend, or even a pet, right? Like, when Puck first said, I'm going to start following you around because it seems like you lead an interesting life, Guts was like, I don't need a pet. Right? Like, even if Guts lets himself think that he has a pet, if that pet gets in danger, then that's a liability for Puck in a fight. Or that's a liability for Guts in a fight.
Yeah, he's not in a position where he can be vulnerable because, like, it seems even in his dreams he's hunted, there's nothing that lets him get away.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who's close to him is going to probably be in danger in some way.
Oh, yeah. When I was talking about him being sacrificed, I think that it's made clear that he is an escaped sacrifice. Like, he somehow got out of the situation.
Hmm. Okay. And like that's he got branded, but the sacrifice didn't complete, kind of a thing.
Right, so that's why he gets pursued.
Ah, I see. But I think the other thing that's important about Puck and Guts showing not affinity for Puck, but tolerance for him, or her, whatever, is if Puck's supposed to be a reflection of the reader and all Guts ever does is shit on Puck. Like, the idea, because Guts is occasionally not always terrible to Puck, that's an opening for the reader, from Puck's perspective, to see that Guts isn't always a bad guy. I mean, he does good things, but he's not always a dickbag, because he's not always bad to Puck. Like, that roundabout identification is what lets you, like, that, I think, is the thing that enables you to have the Luke Skywalker believing that there's something good in Darth Vader moment. Because if he's also just a dick to Puck and straight up like starts to fight him and try to kill him or whatever, you know, then that's just that closes out the reader as well and shuts the reader away and like, okay, this guy's just a fucking douchebag. But because mostly the most terrible that he is to him is just kind of denying him wine and kicking him off a barrel. Like, It's older brother, younger brother crap. But yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, he hurts a lot of people, but he's clearly, as I've, you know, said, really mean to Puck, he never really shows him malice. Yeah. Like, malice is something he reserves for the other people he deals with.
Yeah, he's not going to shoot a crossbow through Puck's nose.
Yeah. Oh, that was so painful looking.
I think the other thing I want to bring up with Puck is Jen mentioned that it was like a cutesy art style, and I think it's an art style that feels more like modern manga and does some of the more manga tropey kind of things with like the big eyes, the sweat drop on the side of the head, and Puck is the only character in the comic that does that. No other characters in the comic do those manga anime tropey things. None of them get the big eyes. None of them do the oro kind of moment, you know? Nobody does that except for Puck. And I think that's another way that the reader identifies with Puck as being kind of placed out of the storyline. Because we're used to seeing that shit. So when Puck does it, it's like, aha, yeah, I see that. I recognize that. That's obviously here. And then it kind of gives you that little in as a reader.
Yeah, and I think that's why Puck being a fantasy non-human character really helps remove the perspective and place it up, pull it out of the story. So I think that reinforces the choice that the creator made for Puck's character.
Yeah. So what do we think of the art style in this? Because we mentioned that the style's consistent in that Puck is the only one that does the anime manga tropey kind of things. But what did you guys think of we've mentioned that it's graphic, we've mentioned the kind of character design for Guts and everything, but like this style of art seems pretty different from manga. This is way more detailed. Especially this comic has the same like weak turnaround time that like One Piece does, when One Piece had like no detail and this is so much line work.
I feel like this is actually a good middle ground because I don't know, like, for instance, I think Kenshin was actually maybe more line work. I think we even said, like, too many lines last week. Whereas here, we get, like, the little details, but it's not so saturated with ink work.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's certainly not as sparse as something like One Piece, where that's a very, like, minimalist design. I feel like realism was more of a goal here than in some of the other things we've read.
Yeah, I think you're right. Especially because whenever I think about the amount of detail in this, terribly enough, I think about the sex scene that the story opens with and how detailed that demon was that he was fucking. That's a really detailed demon. And then Serpentor is really detailed, too. In spots, anyway.
The continuity and flow in battles shows a lot of detail as well. Like, you know, someone gets carved up in the background. In one scene, you see their top flying, and then, like, in the next panel, their guts are flying out. And that's actually, like, it's nice that enough attention was paid that it's still kind of realistic, like, this would still be going on in the back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and aside from that, it all flows really well. I didn't get lost in this action like I have before in some manga. Like, I feel like when the art got chaotic, it was because it was a chaotic scene. Like when he's fighting the skeletons. There's so many of them fucking everywhere, it's a little bit chaotic. But it stops being chaotic when it has to do with the priest and his daughter. And then the action flows really, really straightforwardly.
Yeah, the artist seems to, like, take really good steps to make sure you don't get overwhelmed in whatever's going on. Because, I don't know, battle scenes, I think it's really hard just to convey proper anatomy mixed with movement, mixed with, you know, how you want it to look awesome or flow or whatever. So, you know, you add all of that up, and I think his battle scenes are actually fairly minimalist, because you only really see, like, one action implied per panel. Like, one sword stroke, one kick, one firing of the hand crossbow. Whereas for a lot of the things we read, Western comics or manga, you get a lot of, like, we're supposed to interpolate the, you know, the idea of the flip going on that Nightwing's doing, or the, you know, big sword move that Kenshin has just performed. Here, it's more like, you don't have to figure anything out. There's nothing in the gutters. It's just given, to some extent.
No, I definitely see what you mean. And I think that's also aided by Guts and the kind of character he is in the style, because you can... He takes out, like, four guys with one swing of that big fucking sword. So, whereas with other characters, you'd have to have four swings of a sword for four different characters. Guts can just go... and just fucking swing the thing once. So you only need one panel to see him taking down four guys. And so I think the character design lends itself to this style of action, and you're right, because of it, it's just like, okay, there's eight dudes. That's two swings of the sword. That's two panels. I don't know what else to do here. It's all really, really, really straightforward.
It's actually kind of funny if you think about it, because, like, a lot of the time when we see very, like, busy action scenes, it's because the character is really fast. Like, for instance, if you read any Flash comic, it can get really confusing.
Yep.
What's going on, unless the, you know, the artist takes pains to prevent that. Here, it's almost like slow motion, but then you realize how freaking fast Guts has to be to do everything he does in the allotted time frame. Which is weird, because I think the way the art works here for the battle scenes, it actually distorts the way we perceive timing in the battle a little.
Hmm.
Making it seem, I don't know, maybe not as hectic or fast-paced?
Yeah, I think you're right. I hadn't even thought about that. But it definitely does.
Man, this comic is so... It's fun just in that there's actually a lot to kind of wheedle out of it in discussion. Like, honestly, going into this, it was such a fast read. I was thinking, like, man, I don't know what I'm even going to talk about.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you guys want to get down and rate it?
Sure.
All right. Jen, you go first.
I'm going to give this a 3.5, because I feel inspired to go on and read more of it. I was telling David earlier that many moons ago I had actually watched the anime and remembered it being good, although I don't remember very much about it at this point. So I think I'm going to go back and rewatch that as well. So, I mean, obviously this comic was interesting enough that I want to keep going into it to some extent. I don't know if I'll read, like, all billion volumes that are out. I think there's, like, 38 of them. That seems...
Yeah, looks about right.
That seems a little... like, it's gonna need to get better for me to be engaged that long, but I'm willing to, you know, take the initial plunge and make the investment to read a bit more.
Definitely at least finish Guardians of Desire, because it certainly...
It sounds like it fills out the world.
Yeah, I felt like it really advanced it well, and I certainly want to continue reading. And I didn't feel that way when I read the first one. I wasn't so engaged, but I gave it a push, and it was worth it.
Well, then I will definitely do that. So, I mean, yeah, it was engaging enough. I liked the art, and I think that the characters, you know, we don't know enough about them yet, but they've got good foundations. So 3.5.
All right. I'll go next. I'll give it a... This is hard, because I don't remember what I gave other things. But I know that 3.5 sounds good, so I'm going to go with 3.5.
You probably gave One Piece a 5.
Yeah, well, I definitely gave One Piece a 5, because it's One Piece, and I love it. But this, like... I don't know that Guts is a strong enough character to carry this comic forever. And I'm probably saying that because I haven't finished reading Guardians of Desire. But even if Guardians of Desire fleshes out the world, there's still the problem with Guts. But I think where Guts is not a character who lends himself to being filled out, right? Like we said earlier, Guts isn't going to volunteer any information about himself. He's never going to have, like, a heart-to-heart with Puck. But because I think Puck is going to stay around, Puck is going to have those moments. And, God, that when he looks at that battlefield and says, oh, my God, this is his life. Like, I was reading. I was like, oh, cool, this is Conan the Barbarian. Great, cool, Conan in Japan. Wonderful. All right, blah, blah, blah. Oh, wait. Like, I stopped. And I was like, oh, wait. This is a deep moment about this guy. And about why his character is the way it is, and about kind of the moral underpinnings of his existence. And it's like, all right, cool. That was awesome. That moment when I was reading this comic, like, it made me stop, made me pause and go, that's fucking great. I love that moment when Puck did that, when he was like, oh my God, this dude lives like this, and looks at a pile of bones, including one of the people who tried to help him. And so, for nothing else, if I can get a scene like that every 3 or 4 issues, I'm down to keep reading. That gives it a 3.5 easy. So, yeah, 3.5. How about you, David?
Just going off the first three chapters, I'm going to agree and give it a 3.5. Like I said, at first I wasn't that engaged, but as a story moved along, I became more and more interested, and as I read past and finished the Guardians of Desire, I certainly was like, definitely, I was very engaged in the story, and I thought that this comic is definitely, at least from what I've gotten so far, it's going to be a slow burn, like figuring out what the story behind Guts is. But like you said, Andy, there are these moments in there that really, like, say you, they really, like, pull you in and keep you interested. So I think this comic has, or this manga, it has a lot going for it. So I'm definitely going to keep reading it. And so, yeah, 3.5 for sure. If you like these first ones, I strongly recommend at least finish Guardians of Desire, because I really liked it.
Okay, I'll finish that one. Because honestly, when I was done reading this, I was like, man, I've got a Conan the Barbarian comic sitting on my shelf I haven't read yet.
you should so like it.
I'll at least finish Guardians of Desire.
Yeah, finish it. Finish it and then let me know what you thought.
Okay.
I'm curious.
Well, that wraps up our manga arc. And speaking of finishing, next week we're going to start our Cheesecake series. The best transition ever. we're going to start our Cheesecake series. These are comics that are probably bad. Or at least, I go into the comic book shop, and you know there's that, like, that section that's, like, got a curtain, and you kind of got to go through the curtain to get to that section. But right outside that section, there's comics that are like, oh, maybe that could be behind the curtain? I don't know. We're going to read those. So, next week, we're gonna read Witchblade Origins, Volume 1, Genesis, by Mark Silvestri, David Wohl, and Brian Haberlin, with art by Michael Turner. And Michael Turner, the late Michael Turner, was renowned for the way that he drew women. So I'm happy that we're starting off with Witchblade. That collects issues 1 through 8, published by Top Cow. And the week after that, we're going to read Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose, Volume 1, Witch War. Collects the first 5 issues from 2000, printed by Broadsword. I've never even heard of them. Written and drawn by Jim Balint. And this comic specifies that it's for mature readers only. So if you're a listener that is not mature, don't read it. So I guess I'll not recording that day. The week after that, we're reading Bomb Queen Volume 1, Woman of Mass Destruction. Collects the first 4 issues from 2006, published by Shadowline, written by Jimmy Robinson. And then we're going to wrap it up with Jungle Girl. Now, Jungle Girl is collected in an omnibus, and we're just going to read the first half of the omnibus. It's issues 0 to 5. It's the run from 2007, published by Dynamite Entertainment. The second half is 1 through 5, published in 2008, but we're just going to read the first 5. And those are written by Doug Murray and partially written and drawn by Frank Cho. So this is going to be interesting. I'm not going to be able to read these on the train on the way to work. I don't know when I'm going to read these. I don't want to read these sitting on the couch next to my fiance. Because I feel like if she looks over, she's going to be like, what the fuck are you reading? And just saying something for the podcast might not fly as an excuse. So we will see. Witchblade next week. If you didn't catch all that, or if you want to see what we have coming up after that, go to our website, www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. If you have suggestions, if you think we picked the wrong cheesecake, and you think you have better cheesecake, if you think you knew who drew boobs better, you can send us an email and let us know at
atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
And unlike previous episodes, before the episode gets released, I go out and I look up fan art. And I post it to our social media, facebook.com/APSupercast, twitter.com/APSupercast, and APSupercast.tumblr.com. So I post, like, One Piece stuff, Mass Effect stuff, and then this upcoming week a trailer for Berserk stuff, but I couldn't find any. So I'm not going to do that for the next arc. I don't want to post tarot all over our social media. So we'll find something. Just follow us and see. Maybe we'll get a nice surprise. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
All right. Until next week, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. I finished.
Are you going to end every episode, the next four episodes like that?
I don't know, maybe. But that, I couldn't help myself with that segue. Speaking of finishing.
This is going to be an interesting month.
It's going to be fucking terrible for you guys. I'm so sorry. I'm not going to take anything serious.
What we need to do is find someone who, like, does fan art of these characters in, like, respectable outfits doing career work or something. Right? It's like business casual tarot.
Oh my god, that'd be fucking amazing. I'll have to see if I can... I'll go on DeviantArt. No, I don't want to go on DeviantArt and look for tarot. No.
No. Bad plan.